Blog Talk Radio.
Maxwell, and you are here with the Metsian Podcast, and we are so thankful that you are. Without further ado, let's get right into it. Before we get to our featured guest, let's go around the horn. First up to Rich Spirago in Connecticut. What's going on, Rich?
Hey, Sam. Hey, guys. It's a nice night to rest. You know, we've had a lot of Mets baseball lately, a lot of goings-on that we'll talk about. But off day is welcome. Doing well. Hope you're doing well as well.
Off day is welcome, yet we still miss them. Here we are talking about that pesky New York Mets team of ours. Let's head over to Bensonhurst and talk to Michael Colon. What's going on, Mike?
Hey, what's up? Let's go Mets. Hello, Mets still, and no rest for me. I'm busy rooting on the Brooklyn Cyclones, who are in a second-half pennant chase, you know? So, a lot of fun for me.
And that's what baseball in the summer and baseball in Brooklyn is all about. And let's head out to Long Island, where we find NL Town and Faith and Fear in Flushing, Greg Prince. Greg, it's been a while since we talked. How you doing? Let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets, everybody. This is a strange evening that there is no Mets baseball and there's no rain in Pittsburgh or anywhere else that we know about. But we're going to get through this, going to get to tomorrow and the next Mets game. So in the meantime, yes, go Cyclones, by all means. Great to be here.
Great to have you here. And this is where I want to start with you, Greg. Something that you said to me when I interviewed you way back for that Mets movie I made, the Mets fan movie. But you said something about the Mets doing a better job. They're not good at guarding the gates. They're better at storming the castle. Regardless of where the Mets find themselves in position with the Braves right now, they do have a half-game lead, and it does seem to be, you know, at least for now, that they've been able to weather the storm and throughout the year guard the gate well.
Yeah, it's a little late to come back to my words of wisdom when a lead has dissipated as it has, but it doesn't really feel like one of those years where, oh my God, the Mets are, I'm not even going to use the C word, the Mets are imploding, let's say. They haven't imploded at all. We as fans sometimes treat them as if every three-game losing streak is, in fact, the end of the world. It is not, in fact, the end of the world. I think the guarding the gate, storming the castle dynamic probably speaks more to just the headspace that the Mets occupy. That may, in fact, be historically changing, I'm thinking, under the leadership of Steve Cohen, but that might be getting ahead of ourselves. If anything, probably put that off for another year. Right now, the key is the Mets holding on to a slight lead in the National League East that used to be a larger lead. And I think they're very capable of doing that. It just so happens they're in the same division with a team that is also very capable of being in first place. Probably explains why they've been in first place most of the last few years and even spent, I don't know, collective 18 or so hours tied for first place very recently. Right now they're a half game behind us, but it's going to make it an interesting rest of September and set up a very fluid October, I imagine, between the Mets, the Braves, and, you know, we'll throw in some other teams.
And, Rich, you know, you sometimes wonder, you know, do fans who do complain and worry and bite their nails and constantly think that this team is going to let them down eventually. Did they ever think it was supposed to be easy? Do they want it to be easy? Is that the point? And in terms of, you know, guarding the gate, the Mets have been able to keep losing streaks to no more than three games this season. And that's been rather impressive. And, it, you know, just recently, because they swept the doubleheader, you know, they came out guns blazing that first one to prevent themselves from having lost four in a row.
Yeah, you know, the mark of a good team is the ability to withstand, in the course of a season, they're going to lose games. Right? We have a cliche, everybody loses 60 or 50, whatever you want to call it. Everybody wins 50, everybody loses 50. It's what you do with the middle, you know, 62 that counts, right? So, but the good teams find a way to avoid the significant tailspin, and they typically do that by having good rotation, you know, with a stopper or two. And hats off to Chris Bassitt. You know, they needed that win, and they can say anything they want about, we don't notice the scoreboard, control, you know, insert cliche of the day. But they needed to win the first game of the doubleheader, and they needed to win them both. And Chris Bassitt, though, you know, yeah, they scored in the first inning, but if he's not on his game, I don't care who they're playing, that lead can evaporate very quickly. So the Mets are a very good team. You know, they have a very balanced offense. We know that. They have a good starting rotation. We know that. These things combine prevent those long losing streaks. And there's a reason why 136 games into the schedule, the Mets haven't lost four in a row. The Yankees have, you know, other teams have, basically every other team has. But the Mets haven't, because they have a balanced team and a very good team, and they have the ability to avoid that. So, you know, one more thing I'll say is on Tuesday night, all you saw on Twitter was this felt like 2007. You know, it had that feel. Everybody was freaking out about the C word, as Greg said. But, you know, I see that both ways. I mean, we know intellectually this team is not that team, and this team is far too good to implode. But on the other hand, it did kind of feel like 2007 for one night, and that's okay. You know, that will happen in the course of 162 games. You know, they looked kind of like they were a deer in the headlights, like I don't know, and they were being shut down by a lesser pitcher. All these things happened down the stretch in 2007, so I get it. I get the PTSD of it all, but at the same time, you know, it's okay to think that way for a fleeting moment, but then you realize this team you're thinking is, you know, imploding or accusing of imploding hasn't lost three games in a row all year. While the Braves have been incredibly hot, playing epically good baseball, the Mets have played 600 baseball, which is damn good. It's just that the Braves have been a little bit better. So it's a long way of saying I don't think it's any kind of an implosion or anything like that. I understand why people would react the way they do based on history, but I just don't think this team is doing that.
Neither do I. You know, I've had more faith in this team than I think any team that in recent memory, other than probably the 2015 team, who down the stretch didn't seem to be able to lose. Mike, when we're talking about PTSD, I think there's also Braves PTSD. You know, I think that there's a level of winning this division, because right now both are in good position to it's going to be either or who's going to be the division winner or the top wildcard winner. And, you know, I think that there's just something when you look back on the history of the New York Mets and the Atlanta Braves, and you think about all those dogfights at the late 90s with the Braves always coming out on top, historically so division-wise. There's just something to winning this division that feels more than there's just something about needing to be on top, even though anything can happen in the playoffs. But you want that. You not only want that for the fact that you get to bypass the wild card round, but it's also because it's this rivalry goes way back.
For those who remember, there's a lot of truth to that, those 90s rivalries. And myself, I want to win the division. I don't want to go into the playoffs as a wild card. So my anxiety level is raising just a little. However, I'm still having a lot of fun. I'll pick up where Rich left off in so far as percentile. Yeah, the Mets are playing 600 baseball, but recently the Braves have been playing 700 baseball. So there you go. It's not, you know, any of the Mets failures. It's just that they're playing Atlanta, that is. They're just playing crazy baseball right now. If you want to compartmentalize, you know, look at the last 15 games. Mets are 8-7. You know, that's just one game above par. But let us not forget that they're still juggling injuries. You know, Jacob DeGrom is only 7 games into his season. We had a little stretch there with our Cookie Carrasco, Eduardo Escobar. We lost Brett Beatty, who was called up to fill in for injuries. And look what happened. And Luis Guillorme, who I think is vital to this bench and is a major strength of this team. We need him back as well. You know, so we just need to keep chugging on. And, again, I'm a little offset division flag versus wild card. But, you know, over the next, less than 25 games, 24 games of the season, I'm hoping and I'm crossing my fingers that, you know, we can purge ourselves of these quote-unquote injuries and Max Scherzer comes back and Trevor May comes back. And hopefully we can even get Joey Lucchesi to help us out. So that's what I'm hoping for. And in the meantime, I hope we remain highly competitive, which I do believe we will. This Mets team is a good Mets team. And, you know, they just got to keep battling. I think at some point you would think being that above all other sports, baseball being a game ruled by the law of averages, that Atlanta will cool down somewhat. But, you know, we've said multiple times over the previous podcasts that that penultimate series against Atlanta in October, end of September, beginning of October, decide everything right there. So, you know, are we going to wrangle about how we get there? Or are we just going to take care of business when we meet?
Exactly. And, you know, Greg, speaking of the Braves, obviously, like, you know, just when everybody was talking about the Mets schedule getting lighter, they lose 2 of 3 to the Nationals and then 1 to Pittsburgh. So, you know, I do think I think there's too much put on what that looks like when, you know, good teams are playing bad teams and you got to watch out for the spoils. But a lot has been said about the Braves schedule and the fact that they've really, you know, nothing should be taken away from how good the Braves are. And they've certainly taken advantage of playing all these bad teams. But when I look up at this weekend and I see us playing the Marlins, and of course, you know, there's PTSD with those pesky Marlins as well, but the Mets have been able to handle them pretty solidly this season. You look at that going on the Mets side of things, and then the Braves have to take on a very good Seattle team. I do hope that, you know, what Mike alluded to, maybe the law of averages, the Braves are going to calm down a bit.
It's about time that they do, and they are certainly facing a challenge both with the Mariners and then with a pretty good, not great, Giants team, the fact that they're on the West Coast, which is never easy for teams from the East. You know, I looked at the schedule, and I will confess to having licked my lips, not so much because, ooh, look at all the bad teams, but I do remember only 6 years ago when the Mets made their last successful playoff push, a lot of that was due to having saved up a lot of, let's face it, bad teams for the end of the season. They had a Braves team that was in rebuilding mode, a Phillies team in rebuilding mode, the Twins when they were terrible, the Reds when they were terrible, so they made hay. And, you know, the perennially not great Marlins I would throw in. And this year, perennially not great Marlins. Hopefully, with all due respect to the Marlins, hopefully the Mets can continue to play as they have most years. I know that we tend to snap right back to a couple of season-ending series against the Marlins that took place in a stadium that no longer stands. But the Mets have played well against the Marlins. And, you know, the Mets, again, have played well. Listen, if the Braves are never going to lose again, then all we can do is try to secure the top wild card. I don't think anybody here wants to settle for that. You know, it's all a matter of perspective. 2016, which I just referenced, the wild card looked mighty good from where we were in the middle of August, which was nowhere. When you've spent the entire season virtually in first place, you don't really want to give up with that ticket to the division championship to one of the top two seeds entitles you. I shouldn't even say entitled, but you've earned by having gotten there. It's just been a different kind of season having the Mets in first place convincingly most of the year. And by the way, having withstood, even with the other day, even with the three-game losing streak to two last-place teams, even with the Braves briefly tying them, the Mets have withstood all of this. There hasn't been, as was said, a losing streak longer than three games. This is a team that has played very well, and I really believe, based on not only a doubleheader sweep in Pittsburgh, which is very nice, but just some of the underlying trends I've been watching with the various players, that they're kind of coming out of it, slump-wise, ebb-wise, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, the pitching that has kept them afloat will hopefully continue to keep them afloat. Chris Bassett, I just want to add my hosannas. I think, you know, we have an ace, the ace in Jacob deGrom. We have a guy I've come to think of as the co-ace, who would be, you know, certainly on his own mountaintop anywhere else, in Max Scherzer. To me, Chris Bassett's been the stealth ace of this team. This is the guy that you've been counting on without realizing it throughout the season. I think he is the primary reason there hasn't been a three-game losing streak or more than a three-game losing streak at any point, because when everybody else, and, you know, everybody else has had a lot of great starts, but when anybody else falters, Chris Bassett has stood firm, and I think he's going to go down as, not that there haven't been a lot of great pickups that we made this team, but I think he's going to go down as maybe the key pickup in the last offseason, certainly after the lockout. A great trade that Epler and Alderson and whoever made to solidify this rotation. So, you know, that division is sitting there waiting to be taken. I know that in the six-team playoff structure that we have in each league now, it's all a little more tenuous, even if you've won a division, even if you're getting a bye. But there would be a little bit of emptiness, I think, if you didn't come away with a division flag after so much time in first place. And yeah, especially given who would be usurping it from us in 2022, that we've had enough experience with the Atlanta Braves and looking up at them. Let them look up at us at the end of the season, not only the end of the regular season, but beyond the end of the regular season.
Hear, hear. And, you know, Rich, in about 3 weeks, there's a day off, and then that Braves series does indeed come. So when you think about the Mets' position with a half-game lead right now, all they need to do is just continue to win.
They do. And what I find most interesting about the schedule, and it does matter, I mean, I get it. You have to beat whoever you play. I totally understand that. But on the other hand, I'd rather be playing the Pirates than playing, you know, the Seattle Mariners in Seattle. Look, that's just the reality of it. But when I look at the schedule, picking up on what Greg said, the Braves have six very tough games coming up. You know, the Mariners at home, Mariners are fighting for their playoff lives, and they're a good team. So that's great for the Mets. The Giants, so they're done. They're cooked for the season. But it is still San Francisco. It is still the West Coast, as Greg said. Okay. Then we go beyond that. so while that's happening for them, you know, the Mets have three with the Marlins, and then they come home for three with the Cubs, who have struggled mightily. Remember that by that point, there will be about 20 games left on the schedule for both teams. The Braves will play 7 of those 20 against the Phillies. I think for them, it's actually 21. So they will play a third of their remaining games against the Phillies, who are fighting for playoff position. The Brewers won the first game of their doubleheader today. I don't know what's happening in the night game. So the Brewers are the one, they're on the outside looking in right now. The Phillies are also jockeying for position with the Padres. So they have to win those games. Those will, a third of the Braves games against the Phillies, that will not be easy. So what will all of that will determine what those games mean in Atlanta. You know, will they go in with one team having a one game lead over the other where it's an absolute dogfight? Maybe. Will the Mets go in there, you know, take advantage of the scheduling advantage and perhaps go in there with a three game lead where really if they win one, they're in pretty good shape because then they would go out of Atlanta with a two game lead and play the Nationals for three. I don't remember who the Braves close against. So this, what I'm trying to say is, yes, those games at the end of September, very important games, of course. How important will be determined by how the Braves do against what we'll call a moderate schedule up until that point and what the Mets do against a very soft schedule up until that point. So let's hope that from the Mets' perspective, I think three is the magic number. If they have a three-game lead going into that, I'll feel comfortable. Two, I'll be okay. Anything less than two, and it's an absolute dogfight. And hopefully the Mets, you know, it's right there for the Mets to take. They could give themselves that three-game lead, like you said, Sam, if they just take care of business and win the games that are in front of them.
Yeah, so at that point, there will be six games left. So for it not to matter, they need a six-game lead going – or they need, I'm sorry, a seven-game lead going into that series, which I don't expect to happen. I mean, this is one for the ages. This is beautiful. And to what Rich was alluding to score-wise, the Brewers lead the Giants 3-0 in the bottom of the sixth, and the Phillies have a 5-4 lead over the Marlins in the top of the eighth, and the Yankees and the Twins are tied 2-2. So that's basically what's going on around the horn of baseball. But let's go back to the rotation, and I'll start with you, Mike, since you helped really kind of pinpoint our Metsian precision tonight. And one of the things you mentioned was Taijuan Walker's second half performance. Now, you know, it has not been as bad, let's say. He has not been shellacked. To allude to something Keith and Ron were going on about the other day. But he still hasn't been, clearly has not been as sharp as he was in the first half. What have you seen that's been off? I'll lead it with, I think, you know, he was just a little bit more, he had a little bit more precision with his pitching. He's basically chucking it in many ways at certain points. And I think that's what's leading the batters to be so fine-tuned on his pitches.
Well, I'm still curious to know if he might have tweaked something a couple of starts ago when he kind of tripped himself up on the mound. But that's just a curiosity. What do I see? I'm not a pitching coach. But, you know, it's late in the season. We know last season, when you compare his first half and the second half performance, they weren't quite balanced, so to say. Taijuan had a real good summer, you know, and he maintained an ERA below 3 through July. But since then, you know, it's been growing and growing and growing. It's not out of control. He has a 3.60 ERA, which is you know, still a very good problem to have for your number four starter. As Greg mentioned, you know, Bassett has been a godsend for the Mets. But Taijuan Walker, you know, he's a professional. I'm just hoping that, you know, he gets a second wind here
and finishes out the season, because you know, the pitching staff and the alignments will all be remade for the playoffs. You know, but let's not put the horse before the carriage. I just want to see him finish strong. No, Sam, he hasn't been getting shellacked. But again, we're talking about previous performance versus present day performance, and they're not really balanced out. Again, that ERA is growing, and I hope he can get it back down. And we'll see. We'll see. I have faith. If I didn't, I would say so.
I do too, and like, there's certainly something to be said for what, you know, like you said, playoff rotation is going to look like. But Greg, you know, when it comes to Taiwan Walker, I mean, you know, he's going to be a free agent at the end of the year. I think that there's certainly something to be said about the, you know, the reason he's weathering the storm better this season is because he now has 2 years under his belt of, you know, doing a full season, since he had so many injuries before that. Would you still, I mean, now I'm looking ahead, way ahead, but do you think you've seen enough to invest in Taiwan Walker, or is it something that's like the Met, with everything that the Mets have to do this offseason, I would focus, like we've been saying, even on retaining Bassett, quite possibly, considering what, you know, on top of DeGrom, that's a whole other story. But just considering what those three workhorses do for you at the top of the rotation, you know, where would you go when it comes to Taiwan Walker?
I have to be honest, I haven't given it the slightest thought beyond this season and this Knockwood postseason. I mean, I guess as far as I'm willing to look ahead is, which starting pitcher, if everybody is healthy, becomes a long reliever, becomes this year's Bartolo Colon or John Neese. That's something that will have to be figured out as October dawns and everybody's health is taken into consideration, and that's probably a whole other episode. For right now, you know, Walker last year sort of undid everything wonderful that he did in the first half and the second half. This year it hasn't been quite as dramatic. He does seem prone a little bit to that kind of Steven Matz one bad inning and here we go. Again, not as dramatically, but I think certain things have come back to haunt him. I do wonder if he is, like Mike said, physically okay. Last time around it was a blister. We hope that that's all it is. Think like his rotation mates, you know, he's a very intelligent pitcher, and hopefully there's nothing that he's fighting in terms of he knows that he maybe should take a step back or he's just going to try to power through it. So I don't know exactly why he has maybe leveled off in second halves, other than, like you said, Sam, building up and getting his endurance and his stamina back. Just in a broad sense, looking beyond this year, I like Taiwan Walker and Chris Bassett. It goes without saying, I like Jacob deGrom. I think any Mets fan would say that. There will have to be a number of decisions made. Listen, a year ago, as we were going into the off season and we had nothing to look forward to in the rest of the season, I don't think any of us were talking about Chris Bassett. If any of you guys were, then I apologize. And I think that, you know, I'm sure that Max Scherzer was a pipe dream at the time. And we just wondered if Carlos Carrasco was going to come out of his one inning outings or so, it seemed, in one piece. So really, it's so far away right now. And it's one of those things that personally I would worry about if the Mets were going nowhere. Fortunately, we know that they're going at least somewhere. I do count on Taiwan Walker to be a part of, you know, the team that takes us somewhere. The team within a team, I suppose you might say, in terms of the rotation. And, you know, I found myself thinking a few weeks ago before certain, you know, injuries revealed themselves and other things. I looked at the rotation 1 through 5 in whatever order you wanted to put it, when we had everybody healthy. And I was thinking, yes, we have the greatest pitcher in the world here, and we have the other greatest pitcher in the world here. Yet things worked out in such a way where any one of them was starting a game one, a pivotal game three, a pivotal game five, or hell, a game seven. There isn't anybody I wouldn't have faith in. And I'm pretty sure I still feel that way. So if for some reason, you know, it's not DeGrom or it's not Scherzer, but it's Taijuan Walker with the season on the line, I might not feel as 1,000% confident, but I would not be like, oh my God, how are we going to get through this? You better get the bullpen up early. So, you know, Taijuan's one of the reasons this team has been in first place all year. And if he is your, I don't even want to use the phrase weak link, if he is your least dependable starter, then you're probably getting, you know, six innings and no more than three runs on a typical night. So, you know, not everybody can be on every 5 days, but I think this guy has a pretty good chance of being on more often than not. And, well, we're going to see.
You are listening to the Metsian podcast. And before we move on, I'm going to go back to Greg for his shameless plug. And tell everybody where they can find you. And it's even been a while, by all means, for some out there. Tell them a bit about your Metsian roots.
Okay. My Metsian roots go back to the summer of 1969. Good time to become a Mets fan, and I like to say I'm the original front runner in that regard, but I'd say I stuck with the Mets beyond 1969, and I suppose I'm on the podcast, yours and others, because in 2005 I began with my friend Jason Fry a blog called Faith and Fear in Flushing. I hope if you haven't checked it out, you'll check it out. If you've checked it out before, I hope you'll return. And if you read it every day, thank you. We write about the Mets. We write about being Mets fans, that sort of thing. And we've been doing it forever, vis-a-vis 2005. More recently, in 2022, I began to, if you guys will forgive me, impinge on your territory just a little bit, with a podcast called National League Town with another good friend of mine, Jeff Heisen. Mets fans and Mets history, Mets life, we call it. And we're just basically talking to each other. If anybody wants to listen in, that's fun too. Just enjoying this season a lot. Much like in starting Faith and Fear in 2005 was a great year because the Mets were sort of having a small renaissance. This year has been a hell of a year to pick to get on the Skype and record a podcast about a team that's been in first place all year. And all the ancillary stuff that I'm sure you guys have talked about, starting with the Tom Seaver statue unveiling, going through number 17 being retired, going through the plaque hanging in Cooperstown for Gil Hodges, and most recently, and I know you guys were on this previously, Old Timers Day and number 24, the surprise retirement of it. So, I mean, that has been the backbeat of this season, and when you combine it with a first place team, getting to write about it every other day on average, getting to talk about it once a week, and having the opportunity to visit friends like you, it's just made this season, I don't want to say a dream season, because you can always wake up screaming in the middle of the night if things don't work out. But it's been pretty close. I mean, I've been at this as a fan for 54 years. This has to be in the upper echelon of satisfaction for all the years I've been at it.
I'd certainly say so. And real quick, if you could just comment on your feelings on Old Timers Day, as well as how you felt when you realize what the surprise was going to be about Willie Mays' number retiring.
I mean, from the moment that they said Old Timers Day was coming back, I was just in a state of glee. You can't imagine how great it feels when you've been writing, what you want to call them, essays, columns, blog posts, whatever, for 17 years. Why won't the Mets pay more attention to their history? Why won't the Mets bring back Old Timers Day? When you've had the opportunity, as I was lucky enough to have some face-to-face meetings with people in the Mets offices and ask, why can't you bring back this fan favorite and make us all even prouder of being Mets fans and kind of being met with either silence or being kind of dismissed with, that's not really what we do here. Well, those people aren't there anymore. So just the idea that it was coming back was great. Just watching it come together, the names that were announced over the weeks and months, just whet the appetite. And then to be there at Citi Field a couple of Saturdays ago, watch one Met after another come out and be announced, be greeted, tipping the hat, all of that stuff, which you just, you know, you lap up as a fan. And to kind of forget for a moment all those things I've learned that, oh, well, you know, Todd Hundley was a Met in these years and Bartolo Colon was a Met in those years and Daryl Strubber is a Met in these years, yet in your mind, they're all one big team as you're watching them. And I was willing to just let them be a blob of blue and orange and pretend that this roster could go and beat anybody. And then, like you said, the surprise that as it was being unveiled, first figuratively and then literally, that there's this video presentation that Howie Rose has directed our attention to, and it's all about Willie Mays. And I swear to you, in my mind, I'm on two tracks. One is, could they possibly be retiring number 24 after all the times that people like me have shouted into the wind, please retire number 24 for all Willie Mays means to New York as a National League town and all of that. And yet the other track, I'm like, well, they're never going to do that. So this must be something else. For some reason, they're spotlighting Willie Mays, and I'm sure he can't be here today, but maybe they're introducing a video message. Maybe they're just reminding us that many great players have played for the Mets and worn the Met uniform proudly. But no, it's the actual thing that I just gave up on ever happening. And Steve Cohen made it happen. And to be at Citi Field as this is indeed taking place and to realize that Willie Mays was honored by the Mets at the Polo Grounds when he came in as a San Francisco Giant for all he meant to New York. And that at Shea Stadium they had Willie Mays night and Willie Mays spoke and said, you know, say goodbye to America, that very heartfelt speech. And to think that you have this third stadium where you gave up any thought that you would ever see Willie Mays honored. And even if he couldn't be there in person, and his son later said that he really hopes he can make it here, you know, listen, Willie Mays is 91, we'll see. But just the fact that a moment, even if it was just a few minutes, devoted to honoring Willie Mays, to acknowledging Willie Mays and what he meant to New York, the Mets, the Giants, the National League City, all of that stuff, to honor the wishes of Mrs. Payson and the pledge that Mrs. Payson made to Willie Mays, to have that all come together in the foreground of this marvelous event, even before they played an old-timers game, was one of the highlights of my life as a fan, certainly going to Citi Field since 2009. So, you know, again, the word satisfying comes back to mind. You know, you're no longer... In your mind, you're no longer fighting the team, the ownership of the team that you love. You're no longer having arguments with them, even if it's in your head, as I've been having for decades. Now you get the feeling that the people running the store are, you know, have your best interest at heart, not only in terms of building a World Series contender, but in terms of honoring itself and making the fans feel good about it. And I'll just quote this part of it. By saying, you know, for years, if you talked about why don't the Mets do more of this or more of that in terms of their history, sometimes the fan who was not as interested would say, I don't care about any of that stuff. Why can't they just win? Well, you know what? This, under this ownership, at least right now, is proving you can walk and chew gum at the same time, that you can put on days like Old Timers Day and Keith Hernandez Number 17 Day and continually boost and then honor Gil Hodges as that endless campaign finally came to fruition, and you can unveil a statue and have Nancy Seaver come out and make that day even more special. You can do all of that and still maintain a spot in a playoff race at the top of your division. And it's nice to know that conceptually, no, it's not either or. It's You can have it all. I don't know that we will have the literal all when all of this is said and done for 2022, but man, what a way to be taking the ride, to be going on this journey. And I feel like, you know, on one hand, yes, I'm still rooting for the same team, the same franchise I've been in cahoots with since 1969. And in some ways, it just feels like a totally different vibe, which is why when you asked me before, you invoked the storming the gates, guarding the castle, or vice versa, whatever it was that I apparently said that stuck with you many years ago. It almost feels like we're moving on to a different level, and we're gonna be a team that not only sometimes has to guard the gates, but we're gonna be competent. We're not gonna be out of place as that. We'll see. I think that whole analogy I gave you, Sam, I think it speaks to a mindset and fans who maybe sometimes haven't been able to handle prosperity. And maybe that's what a three-game losing streak in September kind of reveals, that we're still working on it. But old-timers day, it was wonderful. The Willie Mays thing was wonderful. And, gosh, what a nice season it's been.
What a nice season indeed, and thank you for that, Greg. And I think, you know, when we were just talking about the season, we were talking about the starting rotation. So I'm going to segue over to the bullpen here. You know, there's some pieces on the DL, of course, but, Rich, you know, it seems like they've settled into the rotation of Diaz, Ottavino, and Lugo as their number three in the back of the bullpen, the back of the game main rotation to go to get major outs. There's going to be a lot of different people involved, but how do you see their effectiveness going into, you know, continuing into the playoffs?
Well, I think those three guys. I think Buck uses his bullpen very well. Believe me, I watched the game on Sunday, and I watched the game Tuesday, as I know we all did. And some people are saying Buck manages for tomorrow instead of today. You know, he's constantly worried about resting his big three. And you know, they're to a degree, sure. I mean, you know, he did go to the some of the lesser reaches of the bullpen in those games and paid for it. But at the same time, he is kind of looking at the next step. He is looking down the road, and I think we'll be happy he made those decisions when those times come. So he's trying to keep those three guys, who are clearly the most reliable he has, he's trying to keep those three guys as fresh as possible while not sacrificing today. He looks like a man who's searching. I think we are as fans as well, you know, searching for who might be the fourth guy. You know, is it going to be Tommy Hunter? Well, maybe. You know, Tommy Hunter is a bit of a journeyman, but maybe, you know, he hasn't pitched much this year, so maybe he has some bullets left in the arm, so we'll see about that. I so am rooting for Joely Rodriguez. They need a lefty in that bullpen. He just hasn't really done it for any consistent stretch of time. So the hope is that you get McGill back, you know, Mike Mensen, Joey Lucchese earlier, who I think could be a really important piece at the very end of the season into the postseason. You know, you bring him out of the bullpen to get a lefty out. David Peterson could be in the bullpen. He could do the same. So in summary, in my opinion, yes, they're searching for some more quality arms. Trevor May just hasn't been that guy. You know, he's been out for a week. He's probably ready to come back now off the COVID list. But, you know, when you see Trevor May take the mound, you kind of scratch your head. Here's a guy throwing 97, 98. He's been in high leverage situations in the past, Minnesota, but he just doesn't consistently get it done for the Mets, and you wonder why. But, you know, maybe his time is coming. He looked very good against the Dodgers before he went out with COVID. So maybe Trevor May's that guy. Maybe Tylor McGill is that guy if they put him in the bullpen, like I said earlier. Maybe it could be Lucchese. Maybe it could be Peterson. It certainly hasn't been Joely, like we've talked about. So three very reliable guys, looking for probably two more, at least one of them to be a lefty. The good news is they have options.
You know, they have Peterson who can be in the bullpen and possibly Lucchese, but they do need – they can't rely on those three guys. They're going to need at least two more reliable arms out of the bullpen. They will have more to choose from in the very near future, but I don't think you could ride with three. Let's hope they could at least find two more good options and one being a lefty. Or two.
Yeah. Right. No, I completely agree with that. And yeah, when you look at some of those names, yeah, you know, especially with the lefties, I think David Peterson needs to kind of change his mindset and be prepared for that because I guess it was really just one game, and that was the Yankee game, where he got ambushed and wasn't prepared for that. I think it was an eighth inning stint, so. Going to have to work on that. So, Mike, I wanted to just hone in on Ottavino, you know, the kid from Park Slope. It's interesting because he's been on a season-long trajectory ascent. You know, he kind of started out a little rough, but he just has gotten better and better and better. I mean, he's gotten his ERA down. From, I believe, you know, at some point in May, it was probably like 4-something. He's gotten it down all the way to just to think above 2 or so. He's been quite the, you know, it was a stealth move getting him because he was coming off of a not the most consistent season, but he certainly had a bounce back.
Absolutely. He's been better than I expected, I'm being honest with you. But since about midsummer, he's been fantastic. His ERA hasn't been over 3 since June 15th. You know, so when the bell tolls, you know, he's been there for us. I just hope he continues, him along with Lugo and Diaz as the top 3. And otherwise, Rich nailed it. He covered everything. I can't add much more, but I'll be dead honest with you. Ottavino is performing better than I expected, and that always makes people happy, right?
Yeah, that is for sure. And, Greg, this has to do with the bullpen, but is kind of a little off from baseball. But I let's just have a little fun here. What do you think of the whole Timmy Trumpet thing?
I was at the game where he first showed up to potentially usher Edwin Diaz in, and unfortunately the Mets lost that night, so there was no Edwin Diaz. Played a wonderful take me out to the ball game, which if that's all he did, would have been great. And I think if that was all he did, Mr. Jerry Seinfeld wouldn't have had a problem with Timmy Trumpet visiting. I think it's been one of the signature things about this season, both Edwin Diaz and Timmy Trumpet. Imagine that we have landed in a place where we look forward to our closer coming in the ninth inning, not only because we don't think he's going to blow the lead, but because it will be theatrical. And because we will be in this fantastic mood the second he walks out of the gate and everything else that follows. Listen, Edwin Diaz continues to be the Edwin Diaz we've come to love and know and embrace. Not that other guy who was named Edwin Diaz in 2019. You know, Timmy Trumpet is probably, with all due respect to Herb Alpert, my favorite trumpet player in the world. How you know, the bullpen as a whole, what it has reminded me of is, think about a jigsaw puzzle and then think about wanting to move a jigsaw puzzle from one, say, your kitchen table to your dining room table, or from a card table to another card table, and how difficult that is. That's what it feels like to me watching Buck and his coaching staff trying to figure out what the bullpen is going to be from night to night to not overuse Diaz or Ottavino or Lugo, and to figure out who is that guy in whichever inning they need as a bridge, whether it is Rodriguez, who's been up and down, and I share the sentiment on really hoping that, you know, he comes through. I think, you know, in limited opportunities this year, he's shown himself to be incredibly valuable and also not so valuable. Trevor May has been a big question mark ever since he got here. A couple of physical issues in addition to what he's coping with now. And, you know, like I said before, the stray starting pitcher who winds up in the bullpen and how well that starting pitcher adjusts. So, you know, we want to get to the trumpets. We want to have Timmy Trumpet in Flushing in October. We want him riding on a float in November, right next to Jerry Seinfeld. Hopefully there will be a Canyon of Heroes accord signed between the two entertainers. It's a long way to go where that is. You know, you just wish that once in a while, and this is an old plaint, you just wish once in a while somebody could throw a complete game. I realize that's, you know, not going to happen, but gosh, 8 innings, would that be, one great 8-inning performance from each starter in the postseason? I guess that would be a bit much to dream about. Although, I will say at that point, you know, what's Buck saving anybody for? Because I do agree that there has been a long game played, that he is about preservation of pitches and ups and downs and arm use, whatever else you want to call it. But, you know, he's not burning anybody out the way other managers in the past probably have. So if these guys are strong, the bullpen, they're literally in good shape going into the playoffs, going into late September, let's not even go to the playoffs yet, that's almost, I would think, you know that cliche about getting so-and-so off the injured list is going to be like making a trade at the trading deadline? Well, I almost think that if everybody is strong and healthy in that bullpen going into the postseason or getting near the postseason, that almost adds up to a whole other reliever that you didn't realize you had, and that may wind up being an edge. Again, that might be super optimistic, but I really think that's what the whole idea here has been and why Buck maybe hasn't gone back-to-back with certain guys. And he's shown a little faith in the Tommy Hunters and the Joely Rodriguez's, and not always to the benefit of the game at hand, and Adonis Medina, Yoan Lopez, guys who come through sometimes, but not every time. But I do like the idea of putting these guys out there in non-blowout situations, as if to say, look, you're here, you have a chance, show us something. And sometimes it's worked really great. Sometimes it hasn't worked so great. But, I applaud the faith being put in these guys. And have we mentioned Trevor Williams tonight, by the way? I apologize if I missed it.
Yeah.
But, boy, this guy, right? Trevor Williams is asked to do something every 2 weeks, and he comes through for the most part. And you wonder how much of an X factor he'll be, a la, a Glendon Rush or a Rick Aguilera in previous postseasons, a guy who's a starter but is a long reliever when you need him to be. So a lot of names here, and, a lot of guys who are sort of on the perimeter. So, the idea that maybe there is somebody else, lefty, righty, even at this late date, I think we're going to find out that we may not know exactly what we've got, but there's something there. So bring it on.
And Sam, if any of these starting pitchers need help transitioning into a bullpen role for the playoffs, I suggest they pull out and watch video of Sid Fernandez in the World Series.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's basically what Trevor Williams' role has been lately, and he has been magnificent. And I was saying, when Greg mentioned that Buck is doing a good job not burning anybody out, Rich, do you remember the name Fernando Nieves? Like,
sure.
It's the first person I think about when I think about how a manager can burn somebody out, and Fernando Nieves is one of them. But I'll go to you with Trevor Williams. This is the Pete Crow Armstrong Cubs deal with Javi Baez. This is where it continues to pay a dividend, even without Javi Baez still here.
It really does. You know, there was a period when Trevor Williams was, I believe when he was with the Pirates, where he was one of the best pitchers in baseball over a period of time. And, I think Gary was talking about it. There was a period where, like half a season or whatever, where he had the lowest ERA in baseball over, a decent N, as we say, in marketing. It's not a shock that this guy gets people out. I think what is a shock is what Greg alluded to a few minutes ago, which was when he said that the guy pitches every 2 weeks and he's still able to be effective. And the trade has now become the Trevor Williams trade. Javi's long gone. He had a horrible year in Detroit, having a horrible year, about to conclude a horrible year. Trevor Williams is still here. And when they need a spot starter, he's there. When they need a mop-up man, he's there. He's even done a little bit, a little bit of short relief work as well. So talk about we talk about guys like a Joe McEwing, a Luis Guillorme as being the Swiss Army knife. Well, Trevor Williams is a Swiss Army knife of pitchers. He can basically do the three things that pitchers do, starting, long relief, short relief closing, or in an absolute pinch, of course. So yeah, the Mets are lucky to have this guy. And this is a guy who, when you're in the postseason, obviously he's not going to be getting spot starts unless something really goes wrong. But here's a guy that, that you could do a lot of things with. There sometimes are blowouts in postseason games. This guy could save your bullpen. Maybe you have to get a couple of righties out in the fifth inning, a key situation in the middle of the game. He can come on and get those guys. And he throws ground balls, so he can come in and get a key double play. So Trevor Williams is not a guy to be looked past, absolutely. I know nobody talks about ERA anymore, but he does have a 2.92 ERA. His whip is around 1.2, which is certainly solid. He keeps the ball in the ballpark. What's not to like about this guy? His home runs per nine, 1.2, which is excellent. He keeps the ball in the ballpark, throws ground balls, can basically do anything. So sure, and like we said, if we haven't mentioned Trevor Williams, it's time that we do. So if you remember in 2015, Sam, you and I were both at the game against the Cubs when it was absolutely frigid, if you remember that, and they brought out John Neese and Bartolo to get some key outs. Remember that in the middle of the game? I think Neese came in to get out Rizzo at one point,
right,
and Bartolo came on to get a couple outs. So you need these guys. Your star players get you there, and your star players certainly can have a huge role in winning a championship, but you need your role players to be effective as well. And the Mets have guys who could step into those roles, like a Guillorme, like the pitchers we're talking about. So, it's a good feeling. It's a good thing to have.
I think that's a good way of segueing over to the offense, Mike. And you mentioned earlier Luis Guillorme. I do think you are absolutely spot on how much it's crazy to say how much Luis Guillorme makes this team great. But I think you have been able to see what it's like not having him lately. And they're just not as great.
I'm sorry about that. I just put a dollar in the jar. But you're right. He's so vital to this team. He gives Buckshalter so much flexibility that you need in playoff situations. Regular season, again, I use this term, it's a law of averages. When playoff time comes around, you have to execute. And, Luis Guillorme, he's got great fundies. And he's going to prove invaluable once he returns.
Yeah, and Greg, it basically we all discovered Guillorme when he caught the bat in spring training. And that was the first time that anybody knew how good his hands were. And I think the fact that you have such a great defensive player, but now you also have a bona fide major league hitter. You know, I don't even know how many at-bats he's gotten, but let's say he's gotten like 200, 300 at-bats, which is, you always need a crucial player like that who also, he's not a power guy. He just makes contact, sprays it from left to right. You need these guys there for a championship ball club.
He was, before his injury, certainly in the first half of the year, he was this year's answer to Kevin Mitchell, speaking of 1986, and role players who became a little something more, and I really do think we're missing Luis Guillorme. It may sound like a stretch to say I don't think the Braves would be as close as they've gotten if Luis Guillorme had continued to stay on the roster, but there's probably something to it. It was a deeper, more flexible team. The good news is that because he has been out and will, again, knock wood, that he comes back and is in as good a shape as ever, that he will kind of have a little bit of that Luis Guillorme mystique going for him in terms of being a secret weapon. The Mets may be best known to the outside world for their stars, but I think it's the secret weapons that make all the difference in October, and the Mets have several guys who are a little under the radar. We just talked about Trevor Williams, a guy like Mark Canna, who is an everyday player, but he's not one of the stars. A guy who has been coming through suddenly recently, but I was beginning to get some good at-bats, just no results, a guy like Tyler Naquin. And Luis Guillorme is at the forefront for all the reasons that have been mentioned here. He was on a par in the first half of what you're getting from Jeff McNeil, a guy who could play multiple positions, who was obviously on a defensive level all his own, and really transcends the idea of, super sub, utility guy. At National League Town earlier this year, we did a weekly series spotlighting one super utility player from each decade, going back to Hot Rod Keneal and into the 2010s with Justin Turner. Whatever happened to that guy? And we wound up talking about Luis Guillorme in the contemporary sense and how he'd really redefined the role, both historically where the Mets franchise was concerned, but more vitally for 2022. And I think he just brings a whole other dimension. They haven't been able to give a guy like Francisco Lindor a day off. Not that Francisco Lindor really wants a day off, but you haven't had a Guillorme who could slip in there. You haven't been able to move McNeil to third base because you can't just put Guillorme at second. Fortunately, Eduardo Escobar is peaking finally, but you haven't been able to have that flexibility if you wanted to give Escobar a day off. Again, he's hitting well. Nobody wants to sit him down. But the things that Buck was able to do early in the season have been compromised, because of this one domino that has fallen. And again, he's not the star, but he is a huge supporting player. And I really do look forward to him coming back. And despite the fact that we are giving him all of this vocal affection, I still think that he will go under the category of well-kept secret and let whoever is facing us in October find out about him firsthand.
Well said, Greg. You have been listening to the Metsian podcast, and Greg, you have quite the Metsian intuition because regarding the amount of games that Pete Alonso and Francisco Lindor have played was where I was going to go next, as well as Eduardo Escobar. So you laid it up for me perfectly. Rich, going to a lot of what Greg said, and particularly, Francisco Lindor yesterday especially, he had kind of a breakout day, which was nice to see. And both him and Pete have kind of been scuffling, which is one of the reasons why the offense has been a little short of late. But I don't think that's necessarily you can't necessarily pinpoint that to the fact that they don't get that many days off, because that's still what I want out of a baseball player, is for them to want to play every day, because that's what the sport is. It's all about repetition. So, and in regards to kind of the third part of that with Eduardo Escobar, it has been nice to see him coming back off the injured list and from both sides of the plate really looking a little bit more like the player that we hoped he would be all season.
Well, there's a lot there, right? And I think everything you said is right. Buck playing the long game with the bullpen is obvious, and I give him kudos for that. I know it's frustrating at times, but you're going to need these guys to be fresh in October. Okay. He hasn't really played the long game with the offensive players as much, particularly, you know, you see that a lot of these guys out there every day, the poster children for it are Alonso and Lindor. You know, McNeil, for a guy who's had some leg issues, is out there pretty much every day. Marte, for a guy who's had leg issues, is out there pretty much every day, or, you know, has been until he got hurt, of course, in the finger. So is that a source of concern? Honestly, I think it is. You know, I think you see it in Pete. You know, you see Keith talks about it all the time, that Pete has been demonstrating some of the signs of a guy who's a little tired. You know, he's reaching for the ball, that kind of thing. Lindor's defense has remained incredible, and yes, he had a good offensive game in game two of the doubleheader yesterday, but the cumulative effect of playing literally every game, you do wonder about that a little bit. You know, were there times during the summer where maybe if there was an off day, do we know what Davey Johnson used to do, and I think Gil Hodges was being on that too, if I recall, where they would give the guy the day off before the off day, so the guy had 2 days in a row off, you know, chance to rest up a little bit. When, you know, Guillorme was healthy during the season, would it have been an opportunity for Lindor to have a complete couple of days off and just play the long game there a bit? Maybe. Maybe. So I wonder, you know, I am a little concerned about that. I wonder what the impact, the ultimate impact will be. Certainly they can't start resting these guys now, you know, unless something really opens up in the division over the course of the next two and a half weeks, you're going to have to go to the whip on these guys of the way and just hope at this point that, you know, because of their ages, you know, you have Lindor at 28, you have Pete at 27, that they could remain as fresh as possible into October. You know, and other guys, again, like it does seem as though, again, like we talk about Lindor and Alonso, but it does seem like a lot of these guys play every day. Is it a problem? Who knows, really? It does seem like it's wearing on a couple of them. But again, the important thing is let's just hope they have enough left in the tank come October.
Agreed. Mike, you know, do you think that they needed some days off, or do you like the fact that they're gamers? And maybe, you know, that's rude of me to kind of phrase it that way in this modern day, but I think that, you know, again, I like the fact that they want to be on the field.
There's part of me who has that old school mentality, and there's part of me, Sam, as you know, who's conformed to modern ball. Back in the day, we loved it if a player played every game, 162, 154, whichever the schedule demanded at the time. But Alonso and Lindor have played in all but one game. The Mets have played 138, and these two guys have played 137. I don't know how this plays into this, but just the other day, while the Mets were still in Pittsburgh, somebody presented to Pete Alonso, I believe it was, Roberto Clemente's bat. Roberto Clemente's bat was a 38-ounce bat, and Alonso uses a 32-ounce bat. And I just, you know, that's just a sign of the times. Different players come from different generations, and we fans have to, you know, put our demands upon them in perspective. I don't think these guys trained anymore to go 162 games, just as pitchers aren't trained anymore to go the distance in nine innings. we know they can, they're just not trained to do it anymore. So I don't know if this is something going on with offensive and position players. But yeah, Sam, I dig it. I want players in there every day. But then again, modern ball dictates otherwise. We have to take in health and nutrition and hydration and all those other things that are above our pay grade. But those two guys have been carrying this team. There's no doubt about that. And between them, you know, we're talking over 50 home runs and almost 200 RBIs. They've done all we can really ask for. It's the other people, the roster. They all need to rise up and meet the challenge. You know, we're going to talk about Escobar, but that's what needs to go on here. So I don't begrudge Alonso or Lindor a cold streak or slump because they've, you know, played a huge role in getting us this far.
Agreed. And before we get to our final word, I'll just go around the horn and see, you know, what outstanding issues we need to take care of. And I'll start with you, Rich.
Well, on September 15th, Mets played Pirates at Citi Field, and both teams will wear 21 to honor Roberto Clemente, which I know we've talked about Clemente a lot in this podcast in the past, but it's good to note that. That is Roberto Clemente Day, and it just, you know, I'm not sure if planned or not, you know, in a premeditated kind of a fashion. But the Mets are playing the Pirates, and both teams will wear 21, a la Jackie Robinson Day. So I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. And you know, I have said that I wouldn't begrudge Major League Baseball for retiring 21 for Roberto Clemente. And I think that it means a lot in many ways that Jackie Robinson means a lot. So, Mike, both on Roberto Clemente Day and any other outstanding issues for you?
Outstanding issues? Eduardo Escobar is certainly playing of late like he wants to be a September hero. In September, he has a couple of home runs and six RBIs. How many home runs? Give me a second. 3 home runs and 6 RBIs in 7 games. You know, so, you know, hopefully he plays a big role down the stretch. Again, it's the other players aside from Alonso and Lindor who need to step up and you know, carry this team through or at least help in that regard. Roberto Clemente. It's so difficult. I have a passion for Roberto Clemente. And a bias, I would say yes, but the baseball fan in me, sometimes I don't like opening up Pandora's box because then you can make an argument of various players from various countries. Why shouldn't we retire Ichiro's number? What he did in Major League Baseball is great, et cetera, et cetera. And that's my own personal conflict, and I don't mean to toss that into the greater conversation. I fear Pandora's box. That's perhaps one of my shortcomings. would I like to see it happen? I would. But again, you know, we seem to be a people who just won't let things be. There will always be more and more and more requests for more and more and more. People just don't know how to let things be. So, you know, are you going to retire Babe Ruth's number? That's been an argument going on for decades now. You know, so it doesn't start and end with Roberto Clemente is my point. And that requires such a greater roundtable in debate.
Well, I guess the idea of Major League Baseball as if you look at all the teams collectively together as one team, you know, what has stopped it just from being Jackie Robinson? And I think obviously Jackie Robinson means a lot, you know, for this country, and that's a big reason why. It's not just baseball. And Roberto Clemente means a lot for this country from both Latin and specifically Puerto Rican angle as well. So it is, you're right about it being a Pandora's box. So, I think it is a curious question indeed. Greg, both everything, you know, if you want to cover anything that we have just touched upon as well as any outstanding issues for you.
Well, regarding Roberto Clemente Day, I think it's fantastic that we're still talking about Roberto Clemente and still revering Roberto Clemente, and it's not something that has to be brought down from the proverbial dusty encyclopedia to explain who he was, what he meant, what he did, what he gave of himself, how he transcended baseball, that we're approaching the 50th anniversary of his tragic death, and he is still one of, you might say, one of the best-known baseball players that there is or was, and the fact that Major League Baseball is putting this much effort into a Roberto Clemente Day, to having this kind of a showcase in New York, a large Puerto Rican population, excuse me, and, you know, having it between the Mets and the Pirates. Remember, the Mets had a Roberto Clemente Day in 1971, or Roberto Clemente Night. You've probably seen file footage of it often. That's the kind of the picture you see of his family and him in 1971. You know, again, just like it was a great honor to have used Shea Stadium as the staging area for retiring number 42, you know, that night, 1997, we didn't even know that was happening. I don't know that that's going to be the case, but just the fact that it is, you know, a special night and it's not just something that passes with a press release, the idea of everybody wearing 21 and what Roberto Clemente continues to mean that to generations of ball players that never saw him play, that only know him from legend. That's just uplifting, I think, and I'm proud that the Mets are going to be a part of this. And as far as the more mundane, other outstanding issues for the Mets, one thing I thought of while we were talking about Alonso playing every day is Alonso has had the benefit, you know, and again, none of us, I think, cheered this development, but he's had the benefit of now and then playing as a designated hitter. Whether that's a benefit or not, I don't know. Maybe he could just use a total day off once in a while. But I think on the larger issue there is the designated hitter has been in this first year for the Mets specifically, and I'll just leave out all the philosophical stuff and the problems that I had as a National League fan coming into the season, a real roller coaster, because you got nothing out of that position, hardly, in the first half of the year when you were using two younger players who probably didn't see themselves as designated hitters in J.D. Davis and Dominic Smith, one who is gone from the organization, other who is apparently buried in AAA. Every now and then I see some highlight from Syracuse. Hey, Dominic Smith got another big hit, but he does not seem to be on the horizon. Then we went to professional DHs in the persons of Daniel Vogelbach and Darren Ruff, and they seem to know what they were doing. And I won't say they don't know what they're doing anymore, but it's, you know, obvious that they have, to use Buck's phrase, ebbed in the ebb and flow of the everyday. And it makes you realize, as a baseball fan to whom the designated hitter is still something of a novelty in my everyday life, that when a designated hitter is not hitting, there's really nothing about that player, and I mean no disrespect to either one of those guys, but there's nothing useful about them if they have this one job. It's not like you're saying, well, you know, Ray Ordonez can't hit, but boy, look at what he saves you in the field. Unfortunately, that's just the way the game is played now, and I really hope that, you know, a position that is meant for hitting turns out to be productive, because, you know, I have been rationalizing all season in the nine hole. Again, we used to not have a nine hole. We just used to say the pitcher was hitting, that the nine hole has mostly been McCann and Nito making outs lately McCann is hitting some, and we'll hope for the best where Nito is concerned. But I've said, hey, you can deal with that because they're pretty good catchers, and these pitchers like throwing to them, and that's what matters, and anything else is a bonus. You can't say that about the designated hitter. It's either get hits or get somebody else, and it's a little late to be moving those puzzle pieces around. So I do hope that as September goes along, that those two guys specifically, or anybody else who somehow winds up in that role, but I guess it's basically Vogelback and Ruff, find their swing and get in that groove and, you know, make the five hole a factor again, not something that derails rallies. Because, you know, we've been pretty lucky having, you know, the guys we talked about who are out there every day in the three and four holes, mostly Marte, who I think has just been, I'm not giving out awards here, but you can make a case that he's the everyday MVP. Nimmo has been doing great things in center field and getting on base. And we talked about, Neil talked about Escobar. I mentioned Canna before. You can't have the five hole be the nine hole. And I fear that that's what the five hole has become in recent weeks. But, you know, these things have a way of turning around. So as long as we're hoping that certain guys will get on a roll, and certain teams in the division will get off of a roll, I'm willing to show some faith in these two guys in this position that I never wanted to exist, but I have nothing against them. And, you know, we all cheered Daniel Vogelback when he showed up. And I think, at least I know, I felt pretty good about Darren Ruff, you know, watching him come back from Korea and have a great year last year. So that's my issue. More so than anything else, that the one spot in the lineup where there just has to be hitting because it's in the job description. So less designation, more hitting, guys. That's all I can say.
And I'll round it out in terms of outstanding issues regarding the designated hitter. And Rich, I'll ask you first. You know, Mark Vientos. People have been, you know, when they were going on a losing streak, they were just wondering, with the offense sputtering, why he wasn't getting a chance down this stretch. I think there is something to be said about, you know, throwing another young player into a pennant race. But what say you? Do you think that that's something the Mets should consider at some point in this September?
You know, I personally don't watch a lot of minor league ball, and I think in this case, I'm just going to defer my opinion to that of the experts. You know, Billy Epler is invested in this thing. Obviously, you know, he wants to win, as does the organization. If they felt bringing Vientos up was the right thing to do to help the team, I think they would have. I'm not going to offer a guess as to why they have not, but there has to be a reason. And I, you know, they haven't articulated one. So in the absence of that, you know, in the absence of information, people tend to make up their own stories in their heads. And so the story I'm going with is they kind of what you alluded to, Sam. Maybe they don't want to put him in that situation. Okay, you were in AAA. Now you're in a pennant race. You are the right-hand hitting side of the designated hitter on this team. You'll be batting fifth or sixth. That's a lot to do to a young player. So maybe it's that, maybe it's something else. Is it a bit of a head scratcher? Yeah. I mean, you know, you saw J.D. Davis struggle when he was the right-handed half. You're seeing Darren Ruff struggle, but now that he's the right-handed half, you see Vientos in AAA, and it's natural to question why he isn't here. Do they see something or not see something that would his lack of success on this level? Who knows? I mean, I really don't know. But all I will say about that is I understand why people would want to give him a shot. There has to be a reason somewhere. And I'm just going to, in my head, go with the fact that Billy Epler has probably labored over it, thought about it, figures it's not the right thing to do, and I'll defer to his judgment.
Mike, you know, I think you do a good job following all of the Mets minor leagues. So my question for you to start regarding Vientos is, where is the Syracuse Mets in the standings? And what's the current AAA situation with the season?
You caught me off guard with that. Syracuse is not playoff bound. I don't know their record exactly. But insofar as Vientos, look, he was not going to be a decisive player for this team going down the stretch. People on their way to Miami at this moment, if they're not already there, they're the ones responsible for getting this team either to an NL East flag or at the very least a wild card spot. Vientos or no Vientos. I agree with Rich. Everything's done or not done for a reason. But he certainly was not going to be a decisive factor. The people who are on the team right now need to get it done. I would have felt like this a week ago, 2 weeks ago, wouldn't have mattered. And that's where I stand on that.
I would agree. So let's head to our final word, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate everybody joining us tonight and our featured guest, Greg Prince. I'm going to start with you, both final word and shameless plug.
My final word is out-of-town scoreboard. Sam, you gave us an out-of-town scoreboard before in the middle of a podcast. I thought it was professionally done. I thought it was informative and up to the minute. And that just speaks to how much fun this time of year is, that we do look at the out-of-town scoreboard, that we do check our phones. And, yeah, I think we wish we were just checking it for sport rather than hanging on every half inning, wherever the Braves happen to be when they're playing. But this is part of the excitement of baseball. And as many kudos as we throw at the Mets this year, I'm going to lodge a complaint I'm going to say it's the Wilpon holdovers at Citi Field. That's my new policy, to blame anything that I don't love. The Wilpon holdovers, whoever they are, although to be fair, it is a new thing at Citi Field this year. When you look up to left field at the out-of-town scoreboard, whereas you generally saw every score in the major leagues in progress or coming later that night, now it's very colorful. They have the logos of each team and the team colors, and it's very attractive. But it does not have every score in the major leagues in progress. Hence, if you are at a Mets game and you're interested in the score of the Braves game, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say if you're at the Mets game, you are interested in the score of the Braves game, I timed it. You have 4 minutes to keep an eye on the Braves game as it rotates through, because for 3 minutes, it will be absent. So I would wish that on the next homestand and for next year and for years after, they figure something better out for an out-of-town scoreboard, because we're interested in one score in particular. We are interested in all the scores, actually, and they all disappear at some point in this rotation that they have built. But again, we thank professional announcers like Sam Maxwell for keeping an eye on the ticker, on the wire, wherever you're going to get your information. You gave us some important scores before. Perhaps you'd like to update us before we go tonight. But that is part of the rhythm of the game, of the season, especially of September. So score one more for baseball. Put it on both the in-town scoreboard and the out-of-town scoreboard. And for goodness sake, make sure we can all see everything the out-of-town scoreboard has to offer.
Thank you for that, Greg. And again, we appreciate you being on here. And yeah, I will go ahead and a quick update. Bottom of the ninth with two outs. The Twins have a 4-3 lead on the Yankees, who have the bases loaded. The White Sox lead the Athletics 6-0. The Marlins beat the Phillies 6-5, and the Brewers beat the Giants 4-2. So those were some of the pertinent scores that we were looking at during the game, and I appreciate the compliment. So thank you, Greg. Let's head over to Bensonhurst, Mike Lacolant, shameless plug, and last word.
Oh, shameless plug, Brooklyn Charlie Blogger. I spent the whole season doing the 1890s Brooklyn Bridegroom season and following the Brooklyn Cyclones. Greg, before I go any further, thank you for joining us this evening. It's always a pleasure speaking baseball with you. But I reserve my final word for Brooklyn. They are in a first-place battle with the Yankton Valley. They entered tonight's action with the magic number 3 for the second half, that is. Brooklyn won, Hudson Valley won, so the magic number is now down to 2 with 3 games left in the season. Go, Brooklyn.
Go, Brooklyn, indeed. Let's go, Cyclones. Thank you for that, Mike. And we're going to head to Rich Spirago. Shameless plug, final word.
All right, thanks, Sam. Shameless plug, Mesmerized Online is where I do my written stuff. And last word is capitalize. We talked about it earlier, gentlemen. You know, the Braves are looking at 6 fairly tough games while the Mets take on the Marlins and the Cubs and going a step beyond that, 4 with the Pirates. So the Mets, it's right there. They just have to reach out and take it. They have to capitalize on the situation themselves in good stead for the final 2.5 weeks of the season. That's the word. You have the opportunity. You're playing, Keith likes to call them second division teams. Capitalize. Go out there and capitalize.
Well said. And I will say my final word is keep it pushing. Little change from, 2015 had keep on pushing. This year, keep it pushing. It's right there, like Rich says, for the taking. Mets are in control of their own destiny, so control the heck out of it. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the Metsian Podcast tonight. Thanks to Greg Prince for joining us, Rich Spirago, Mike LeColant. Thanks, all. Let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets. Thanks,
go
everybody.
Mets. Good night,
go
all.
Mets.